Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome back to In the Pink with me, Natalie Pinkham, and Bose, helping you stay connected throughout the lockdown and beyond. And beyond is the crucial word this week, my friends, because those lockdown restrictions are finally easing here in the UK. And it's been a challenge, of that there is no doubt, but it's one I feel that we've come together and helped each other through. And the key to that has been communication. So thank you for all your feedback on the podcast and for your ideas and those that you want to hear from, and plenty more great guests on the way. Up next is the world's most successful track cyclist ever. He's Great Britain's joint most successful Olympic athlete of all time, with 6 gold medals and 1 silver to his name. Have you guessed who I'm talking about? It is Sir Chris Hoy. And we talk throughout this In the Pink episode about family, mental health, motorsport. He's a massive fan of Formula One and races himself, as well as what it takes to be a winner. And boy, does this guy know all about that. And of course, the transition to life after professional sport. So here he is. He's a great guy. He's a great family man. And he has got a great life story. Here it is, the life story of Sir Chris Hoy. Well, great to see you. And I have to say, you don't look like you've suffered from the normal lockdown, feral, crazy hair, put on weight, big hairy beard. You haven't got animals growing in your beard like the twits.
Well, I think you're being very kind, actually, because I feel like I've gone a bit feral. I've never grown a beard before. It's kind of a half-arsed attempt. It's a little bit patchy at the moment, but yeah, we'll see. By the end of lockdown, I might have a nice big, full bushy ginger beard. You know, who knows? My wife might want to leave me if I do that. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I was going to say, the only person who matters in this whole Beardgate thing is Sarah. So what does she think of it?
She quite likes it, I think. Yeah, unless she's just been kind to me. I don't know. But yeah, I think, I don't know. We'll see. There's more important things happening out there just now. But right now, yeah, it's itchy. That's the thing. You know, when you've never grown a beard before, I mean, you won't know this thing, but yeah,
I don't know. 7 weeks in lockdown.
Well, you know, you're looking like, have you been, you know, joking apart, how do you guys, you know, TV presenters are used to, obviously, in front of camera the whole time, you've got people who are doing your hair and your makeup.
Yeah.
I mean, for you, it must be, when you're working and doing stuff from home, to still be so presentable. I mean, how do you manage it?
It's a shock for my poor husband. Actually knows what I look like now, with no roots, blood, nails, Botox, you know. God, it's a disaster. It's all good. It's actually been lovely. I've quite enjoyed the calmness of it all. Obviously, as you mentioned, there's much more important, bigger picture out there, a lot of people suffering, and you kind of feel a little bit useless, really, in all of that, don't you? You kind of want the need to help them more. But in terms of the four of us in our family, we're missing our grandparents and our cousins, brothers and sisters, but otherwise, you know, we're good. How have you kept the kids busy?
Tiring them out physically, that's the real kind of strategy I've been employing. So I've been getting Callum and Chloe out on their bikes. You know, we've got a bit of garden space where they can ride around. And actually Callum, for the first time ever, because the roads are so quiet, I've gone out with him for a ride, just the two of us. And he takes some food and a drink with me, and basically let him lead the way in terms of how long he wants to go for. He did about 9 miles the other day, and it, I mean, I was tired, and we live at the top of a hill, so we got to ride back up this hill to the house, and he made it all the way up the hill. He sleeps well after that, put it that way. But we're having a lot of fun on the bikes.
That's amazing. I really want to talk more about Callum later, because he's a little miracle baby, isn't he?
Mm.
And actually, 9 miles. What is he? 5 years old?
5 years old. Yeah, five and a half now. So
to do 9 miles.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't even riding a bike when I was five, so he's doing all right, I think. Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's start at the beginning for you and your childhood, when you first did get on a bike, because, okay, maybe it wasn't as young as five, but you certainly caught the bug pretty early. Tell me about the ET story. It's really cute.
Yeah, well, I guess I was about 6 years of age and ET came out as a film, and I think somebody had it on VHS on the video, and I sat down and watched this movie, and everyone else was talking about the alien and about, you know, ET as a film, but all I could think about were these amazing bikes. I'd never seen a BMX bike before, and it was the first time I'd been exposed to this new way of riding a bike, these, you know, going over jumps, carving through turns. It was just, you know, it's hard to imagine now, because BMX feels like it's been around forever, but it didn't exist when I was born, and here was this new way of riding a bike. So immediately I watched the film, I saw the BMX bikes, and I thought, this is what I want to have a go of. So tested my parents, and, you know, I said, oh, can I get BMX for my Christmas? They were about £100 in those days, a lot of money. And my parents, being good thrifty Scots, thought, well, you know, maybe it's going to be a passing fad. We'll just get them any old bike. They got a bike from a local jumble sale for £5, secondhand. And my dad resprayed it black, and he put BMX stickers on it and BMX handlebars and grips. And that was my first bike, and I loved it. And that was how I got into cycling. So really, I've got Steven Spielberg to thank for my cycling career.
And we need to thank him too. I love the fact that your dad pimped your ride as early as 6 years old. Nice.
He loved it. I mean, it's looking back now. Yeah, I mean, to a six-year-old's eyes, it looked just like the real thing.
Oh.
But yeah, didn't last long, to be fair. I mean, it was as soon as I got to the point of riding the bike, I then wanted to jump, because I'd seen the film. I'd seen how they were all kind of, you know, getting air. And the trouble was, the bike wasn't designed for that kind of abuse. So I built ramps in the back garden with a plank of wood and bricks. And before too long, it just basically snapped the frame. So I think they realised this is going to last a bit longer than a few weeks. So it's not a passing fad. Maybe he does need a proper bike. And then the next bike was a Rally Super Burner. And that was when it all started.
Yeah, as you say, not a passing fad. But how did you go from a very enthusiastic, passionate kid to the world's most successful ever track cyclist? I mean, that's a hell of a jump.
Yeah, it wasn't a meteoric rise, and I wasn't one of these kids that you would just have picked out at a young age and thought, well, they've got, you know, sort of inverted commas talent for that kind of thing. Because I don't really like the word talent, because it kind of, the connotations are that it's easy and that you just sort of get out of bed and you're good at whatever it is you do. But the reality for anything, I think, is that you have to, you know, it's hard work, it's consistency, it's hard graft that gets you there. And I think that we're kind of fed this notion of talent in all walks of life, whether it's singing, dancing, sport, whatever, the word talent just gets overused. And I think for kids growing up, knowing that whatever it is you're passionate about, whatever it is you've got an interest in, that's great, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. And for me, I just loved racing bikes. I loved riding bikes. I did BMX. I got into mountain biking. I joined a cycling club in Edinburgh when I was about 14. And they met once a week at the velodrome at Meadowbank. And I got a bike there, and I just started racing once a week. And it wasn't, as I say, I wasn't great at the start. I was just sort of plodding away, steady improvements. But I guess what I did have was ambition. I wanted to get better. I wanted to see how far I could go. And yeah, it was a very gradual rise rather than a sudden burst onto the scene.
Okay, but you have made an incredibly successful career of it. Was there a plan B, though? I mean, I know you went to university, so you must have had it in the back of your mind that if this doesn't work out, I've got another path, or did you?
Yeah, well, it was never going to be a career, because there was, I don't know, it's like there was absolutely no chance at all of making a living out of cycling. In the early days, there was no support financially. We didn't have an indoor track to train on, you know, 12 months of the year. Britain as a track cycling nation were, you know, a sort of C or D grade nation, really. We had one or two individuals who were successful, but no team set up. So there wasn't even a possibility. Even if you had the potential, there wasn't a pathway to follow like there is now. So if you're a 15, 16 year old athlete now, you're into cycling, you have the ability, you're going to work hard, you can follow a pathway to success. But back then there wasn't. So it was always about, you know, have your sort of career, or get your qualifications, have a backup plan. And then cycling was a hobby that I was basically doing it to see how far I could go, to see if I could make the team for the Commonwealth Games. And the Olympics was the dream, but it was such a pipe dream in those days, because we didn't even have, there was nobody in Britain winning medals in sprint events in my lifetime. I think Reg Harris was the last, you know, big name in sprinting, and that's back in the 1950s. So we had nobody to really emulate or look up to or have as a role model within the UK. So it was tough, but the heart of it all was just that I loved for what I was doing. I loved racing my bike. I loved riding my bike. I loved being with the guys, with the team, you know, having a goal to work towards, training hard. And over the years, it just, so many things happened at the right moment for me. Really lucky, you know, sort of sliding doors moments where, you know, I finished university in 1999, and that was just when lottery funding had started. So it meant I didn't have to get a full-time job. I could pursue my dream for a year or two and see how it went. And, you know, it was £10,000, and that was like £1 million back in those days, because it paid my rent, it paid for my food, it paid for, you know, all the kind of the things you needed to do to be a full-time bike rider. And within a year, I was at the Olympics in Sydney, and we got a silver medal in the team sprint. And it was like you were living your dream. It was incredible. You just did it for the love of it. You weren't thinking beyond the next year, but it was just, a huge amount of fun.
So what were you going to be had this cycling dream not materialised?
I've got no idea. So I started out, I went to university in St Andrews to do physics and maths, and I quite enjoyed that school. But then I went to university and it was just so dry, and I just didn't enjoy it. And what I have learned in life is that you work hard at the things that you enjoy, and you know, it doesn't matter how hard or how willing you are to be committed to something. If you don't enjoy it, you won't work hard enough. And I was having a really good time at the university, having fun socially, but I wasn't enjoying the course. So I changed to do sports science in Edinburgh. I went back home, so partly to have a proper go at cycling. And this was about 1996, I think it was, 1995, 96. And it was just, I was finding myself looking up scientific journals, trying to answer the questions to the things that I couldn't get an answer from, because I didn't have a coach. We didn't have people helping us or guiding us. So I always wanted to know about how to train for sprint events. There were lots of endurance cyclists around you could talk to, but very few sprint cyclists. So I had all these different questions, and I thought, well, if no one can give me the answers, I just have to go out and find them myself. So I'd go to the library, get all these journals out, look at, you know, information on strength conditioning or power athletes from different sports, and try and write my own training program and sort of formulate it that way. And then I realized, well, why don't I do a degree in this? Because I may as well get something from this. You know, yeah. I'm interested in it. I'll work harder at it. So I went to Edinburgh University and did sports science, and I loved it. And it never felt like I was like a chore, like I was having to work. I was just really interested in it.
Right, let's talk about how you went from that into this incredible Olympic journey that you embarked on. Your first gold medal in 2004?
Yep, that's right. Right.
And I'm not going to gloss over that, because that was an incredible moment for you. Just reflect on that for us.
Yeah, it was. I went into it as world champion. So the event I was riding was the 1,000 meter time trial, where you only get one ride. There's no heats. There's no qualifications. So you basically don't know what your rivals have got until it's too late. So, you know, you go up in reverse order of your seeding. So I was world champion. I was last to go. So I sat and watched everybody post their time before I went on the track. And I think four riders before I went up, a guy from Australia, Shane Kelly, he went up and broke the world record. And then the next guy, the German, Stefan Nimka, broke it again. And then Arnaud Tournant from France broke it again. And I was last to go, having seen the world record broken three times. So it was just a really, although it's a very physical event, it's a kind of pure event, the time trial. There's no tactics involved. It's your strategy. You're just racing against the clock. But the mental side of it is really a huge challenge, because it's so hard not to be distracted by the times that the other riders have posted. So I got to the start line. You know, it was just everyone else had finished their ride. It was me to go. I was last to go. And it just felt like the most intense pressure I'd ever felt in my life. And this was the most important moment, because this is my chance to become Olympic champion, my dream. And the only way I got through it was just by basically visualizing and focusing on myself and not worrying about the variables, not worrying about what anyone else has done, because I had no control over that. Just literally stick to the game plan and get it out, get that, all those, you know, all those thousands of hours of hard work, the visualization, the mental preparation. And it was so surreal because I crossed the finishing line and it was so like all the visualizations, all the kind of mental rehearsal. It was almost like the perfect ride. But I hadn't visualized what was going to happen after the finishing line. So normally you celebrate straight away if you've won the race. And I crossed the line and I just for a moment thought, is this actually happening? Is this real? And I looked up at the scoreboard and I saw my name and the number one and OR for Olympic record. And it was just this is actually really odd. But I should put my arm up in the air just in case I have actually won this, in case this is real, because I'll look really odd if I'm not celebrating. And I did about a lap or two, just looking like I'm completely in a daze, until I spotted my family up on the stand waving the flag and the banner. And it kind of sunk in that this is actually happening. And yeah, I achieved my dream of becoming Olympic champion. I'd say other than in London 2012, that was the most significant moment of my whole career.
And how did you keep that mental strength up? Because that must, as you've touched on, been intense. Was that all self-coached, all visualization? Because it's a hell of a lot for one bloke to take on.
I think in the early days before we had, so Steve Peters was our psychologist, and he changed the way that I looked at my life, not just my sporting life. But I didn't really engage with Steve when he first joined the team, because up until that point, we'd never had a psychologist. It was seen as a bit of a kind of mysterious thing. And also it was almost like a showing a sign of weakness to go and see a psychologist. You know, if someone in the team was seeing a psychologist, everyone was like, what are they, you know, what's he talking about? And, you know, does he make you lie on a sofa and talk about your childhood and things like that? You know, you thought it was some sort of, I don't know, almost a sign of weakness that you had to see a psychologist. Whereas now, of course, we know that's absolute nonsense. And there's so much you can gain from seeing somebody who can help your mental side of your sport, because often the mental side is what separates the first from second from third place. So Steve Peters was incredible. He taught me about perspective in life, about, you know, caring about what you're doing and have passion for what you're doing, but understanding that it's pretty trivial. Unless you're saving lives, what you do is pretty trivial. So the consequences of getting it wrong, you know, if it goes wrong, so what? You know, you're riding bikes in anti-clockwise circles. It's not life and death. You've got to enjoy it. You've got to give it your all, but not fear the outcome, not worry about failure. And also not let success be a distraction too. You know, not you're not going into the race thinking about the gold medal or thinking about what would happen if I lose this. You're thinking about the process. So you focus on the process and not about the outcome. You focus on the process, the outcome will follow. But just it's the kind of ABC of what you need to do will hopefully lead you towards that end result. But you never worry about the end result when you're doing it. It's just the process.
That's so interesting, because naturally I would assume as humans, I know I do it, I would definitely be thinking about the result. If this happens, I'm going to be an Olympic champion. If it doesn't, I'm not. And you bounce between two extremes, and that can't be healthy. But how on earth do you sort of compartmentalize enough to sort of keep those thoughts from creeping in?
Well, you're absolutely right there. You look at football as an example. Look at the penalty shootouts in a World Cup final or a semi-final, and you're stepping up to take that penalty. And these guys, they could score a goal, you know, a penalty with their eyes closed 999 times out of 1,000. But that one time where they've got to do it, and they're either going to be the hero or the villain if they miss. And you know, that is a classic example of being able to focus on the process in that moment, not thinking, God, if I stick this in the top corner of the net here, we're going to be in the World Cup final, or we're going to win the World Cup. And equally, I'll be on the headlines if I'm the one that misses it. There's that pressure, that weight, and they change the way that they approach the ball. They might make a last second change of decision about where they're going to go for it. They might end up sticking it in the other corner and missing, or sticking it straight to the keeper or whatever. So for me, the way I got around that whole, you know, worrying about the outcome, it was purely focusing on the process. Having the visualization part of it is very important. So, you know, visualizing exactly what you want to do through each stage of your race, but not having such a rigid plan that if something happened or you know, like in the Kieran, for example, or the sprint, there's lots of variables, things can change. So you can't just have one plan, but it's about being able to refocus and reapply the next plan. If plan A is not working, you change to plan B or plan C or plan D. But visualization is a really powerful tool, definitely.
Now, you said that 2004, aside from 2012, was probably the most significant moment. Is that because it released some kind of pressure off you in a way, because you'd proved yourself now, you could almost relax and say, right, I'm established now as an Olympic gold medal winner. I can just get on with what I'm good at now.
I think it's because it's such a big thing. And I always, growing up, I always saw Olympic champions or people who were successful in their sport or their career. They were just different to the rest of us. They were born that way. They were destined to be champions. And it was in 2000 when I saw my teammate Jason Queeley win the gold medal in Sydney, that my kind of, my whole, it was like a real light bulb moment, because I suddenly thought, well, here's a guy who's just, he's just Jason, he's my mate, he's an ordinary bloke, you know, he's not a superhero like I thought Olympic champions would be, and he's just won a gold medal. And he was the first person that I knew personally who had, you know, become an Olympic champion. And I thought, well, if he can do it, maybe I can get close to that. And it was a real inspiration to see him win the gold medal. So 4 years later, I think winning an Olympic gold medal was without doubt the biggest target and the biggest ambition I had. And once you've won that gold medal, you're an Olympic champion for life. So, you know, I think there was pressure lifted and it was significant, but on the downside, nothing was measuring up to it. So every race I went to after Athens, you go to World Championships the next year in LA, 2005, and it was just, I felt a bit flat, and I couldn't get the best out of myself, because I felt like this isn't as important, it's not as big, it's not as great as the Olympics. So I definitely experienced a bit of a dip after the 2004 games, and it took a while to start changing things around. Ironically, the biggest or one of the most important shifts in my career was when that event was dropped from the Olympic program. So in 2005, they dropped the kilo from the one I was Olympic champion in, the event I was Olympic champion in, from the Olympic Games program in Beijing, excuse me. And so I had to make a decision. Do I retire now, age 28, 29, or do I try and take up a new event and adapt and sort of learn a new skills and tactics and techniques? And it was purely because of the support around me, the amazing structure, support, the coaching infrastructure, the psychological infrastructure too with Steve Peters, that allowed me to pursue these new events and to develop these new skills and go on to win the three gold medals in Beijing.
The world continues to evolve, and the new norm isn't fully clear yet. But what does remain constant is the core message from our friends at Bose. Stay calm, stay centered, and stay connected. Communication is key in everything we do and goes a long way to nurturing both ourselves and our relationships with others. So continue to talk about what matters to you. And don't be afraid to block out unhelpful noise, or indeed to embrace silence, because doing both can be great. Some of the ways we work will have changed forever. Embrace that. Make those new ways work for you. Shape the new norm to suit you. Feel more, do more, be more with Bose. I mean, just the three gold medals. I have to say that 2008 does seem like a watershed moment, certainly from the outside looking in terms of the revolution of cycling. To be not just a part of that, but to be leading the charge, a trailblazing to that extent, really putting cycling on the map. How exciting was that for you at the time and now to look back on?
It was an amazing time. And even, you know, normally when you're in the middle of something, you're not aware of the significance or just the relevance. And, you know, it's usually 5-10 years back, you know, you can look back with hindsight and look at it all. But even then, we realized something special was happening. There were so many athletes in all events that were coming towards the peak of their career, really special athletes. We had a team of people who, it was the only time really, and I mean, the team has been amazing in many phases, many eras, but I think the 2006 to 2008 was the peak for the whole team. The way that every single person, from the people booking the flights to the physios, to the mechanics, to the riders, the coaches, the senior staff, everybody felt like you were all on the same side, all pushing the same direction. Everybody had the same mission. It was, and you could feel the morale was just, it was like a kind of getting amplified, you know, the snowball effect, gaining momentum as we got closer to Beijing. But even with all that and all the positive feeling and all the success leading up to then, I don't think we really believed that it was going to be as successful as it was. And it was, yeah, it was almost as though the first night of competition, we were in the team sprint and the French were the favourites. It's one event that we hadn't won a gold medal for about 6 years, really, at the men's team sprint. And the French were hot favourites. They got onto the track and we posted our qualifying time right before they got on the track. And we broke the world record. And as we were sort of rolling around, I could see the French walking up onto the track to line up and get into the start gate. And I could see one of the French riders look up at the clock, at the scoreboard, which you never do. You know, when you're about to race, you're focusing on yourself. But I could see him looking up and he sort of shook his head as he looked at the time. And I could see it was like the penny was dropping. He was like, oh my God, they're, you know, they've just broken our world record. I don't think we can go as fast. You could see him just the negativity soaking in. And they went slower than us in the qualifying. We won the gold medal that night. And it seemed to set the tone for the rest of the week. And it was, yeah, almost every time the Brits got on the track, you could see the posture, the shoulders are like, oh God, you know, here they come again. And it just demoralized the other nations. I think we won 8 gold medals out of 10 events. And it was, quite a remarkable few days, a really special time.
And I do remember watching it thinking, yeah, it's a given. We're going to take gold again. I mean, when do you ever go into a competition feeling like that? Particularly for you, making that big transition in terms of the disciplines that you were competing in. How tricky was that, both physically and mentally? I know you say you had a great support network around you, but a lot of that would have come from you.
It was hard because the kilo as an event is very controlled. There's very few variables in there. The fastest rider always wins. You know, it's a straight shootout against the clock, whereas the sprint and the Kirin are crazy events. The Kirin originated in Japan as a gambling sport after World War II, so it's like a $10 billion a year industry now as a gambling sport. It's huge. There's one big day they have in Japan, the Grand Prix, and on that one day there's more money bet than the entire British horse racing season in one day. I mean, it's absolutely massive over there. So the reason it's successful is because the reason they use it as a gambling sport is because it's very unpredictable. So here was me going from one of the most predictable controlled events to the least controllable event. And I didn't like that feeling of lack of control. I wanted to know that if I got to the start line having done everything I could, then I'd have a really good chance of winning. So I had to, I guess, ride to my strengths. So one of the things that I learned in this 2 or 3 years before Beijing was to play to my strengths. So a kilo rider does a 4-lap effort, 1,000 meters. The Kirin, you've got 2.5 laps. So my struggle was the peak speed, racing against the guys that had a little bit more speed, but could go for a shorter distance. I thought, well, why don't I just take it out from the front, lead from the front, use my kilo strength, and all the chaos that's happening behind, it doesn't matter what's happening behind you. If you're in the front on the black line, taking the shortest route, then you're controlling all these variables. So I started racing from the front, and nobody had ever done that before, because usually if you do that, they sit behind you, they get in the slipstream, and then they pop past you at the end. But I just managed to learn how to, I guess, gauge my effort. So it wasn't like I was purely sprinting from the start, but I just ratchet up about 1% every sort of 50 meters, 60 meters, until I was absolutely on it for the last lap. And by that point, they were all strung out, and it was harder for them to come past. So it was finding ways to play to my own strengths, and to try and control as many variables as possible in a really unpredictable event.
God, that's fascinating to listen to, because so many people should be able to apply those principles to whatever walk of life they're in, whatever they're doing. It's about controlling the controllables, but, you know, perhaps just reassessing how you approach things. That's really interesting for business, life, sport, everything, isn't it?
I think it's understanding your own strengths and weaknesses, trying to improve your weaknesses, but also play to your strengths wherever you can. And I think being proactive, you know, in a race situation, certainly in the sprint and the Kirin, the first person to make the move, the first person who initiates their tactic on the race has a, you know, we used to do all the analysis on it, and it was about 80% chance of winning. If you're the one that's proactive and makes the move, then everybody else is reacting to you. So immediately they're not able to impose their tactics because they're reacting to yours. It doesn't mean to say, you know, if you go flat out from the start every time, it's not going to work every time. But if you can dictate the tactics, then everybody else is on the back foot. So it certainly applies to other, you know, avenues in life, certainly. And I would say that was the biggest thing I did to try and become successful in these new events.
So interesting, because it is about unnerving the opposition as well, isn't it? You've suddenly got a psychological advantage over them. Okay, let's fast forward then. So we go into this sort of golden era for cycling, and then that means that by the time we got Olympics on home soil, you know, you're riding the crest of a wave, and you've got this whole kind of army of fans behind you. But quite literally, you were at the forefront with as the flag bearer in London. I mean, what a moment that must have been.
Well, it was never really on the radar. So I had, you know, everything was planned to, you know, with real precision, and we kind of use F1 as our gold standard to look to in the way that F1 teams operate. And Dave Brailsford used them as his, that was the template really, marginal gains. That whole philosophy came from Formula One. So many things are, you know, you're trying to think of every single possible thing to control, to optimize, to get the best out of. And then at the last minute, the spanner in the works was, you know, guess what? You've been nominated to carry the flag by your teammates. And it one of the biggest honors you could possibly imagine. But equally, it was like, well, you're going to be walking for about 4 hours or on your feet for at least 4 hours on the night. You're racing, you know, 3 days later. You would never, ever, as cyclists, one of our mantras are, you know, don't stand when you can sit and don't sit when you can lie down. So, you know, cyclists never walk anywhere. They will rest their legs at any opportunity they can. And here I was, right, here's stand with a flag and stay on your feet for 4 hours, you know, a matter of a couple of days before your competition. But there was no way I was going to miss it. So it was like, well, right, what do I do then? Well, you know, get one of these little, you know, these little chairs that fishermen have, or, you know, they're kind of, you can, the portable chairs you pop out so you can sit down and rest your legs. So when you basically line up at the village and make this walk, it's only about maybe 2 miles, but from the village into the stadium. And but you're, it takes you 3 or 4 hours to get there. You're doing it in really slow segments. You stop and there's crowds on either side and you're waving and chatting and, you know, posing for photos and stuff. But it takes so much energy, sort of emotional energy out of you, because it's so exciting and you're so hyped up. The whole team's with you. That there's a risk that you can get through the opening ceremony and be absolutely drained. And even like now, it's quite pertinent to the world we're in now, but even things like picking up bugs. So you're shaking hands with so many people, you're high-fiving. So you have this, I had my gel on the little pack on my hip, and I was just putting hand gel on every sort of 30 seconds to try and not pick up bugs, because in Beijing, the triathlon team was wiped out with a diarrhea and vomiting bug, and they were in our block. And we were told, you know, you don't touch lift buttons, don't touch door handles, don't touch handrails, anything at all. Don't shake hands. You know, we've got to be on full lockdown here to try and minimize the chance of getting sick. And we got through it unscathed. So you learn these little things, just marginal things you can do to minimize risk. So anyway, got to the final point of about to walk into the stadium with the flag. And it was just like this moment of realization that the last 4 years, the hard work, the ups and downs, the injuries, the defeats, the, you know, I only just got selection for the Olympics as well. The things hadn't gone that well the last 6 months, and it was a really tough time. And I was 36. So it was, you know, for an athlete in a sprint event, I was really old. I was the oldest of any gold medalist, certainly in history, to do a sprint event in cycling. So all these concerns and worries and negativity, you know, ups and downs, I finally got there. And I stood there with this flag and walked out, and Bowie's Heroes pumps out, and there's confetti, and it was just the noise, everything about it. I remember thinking, the last 4 years, the hard work, it's been worth it for this moment. So it took the weight off my shoulders. I didn't feel as if I had extra pressure as a flag bearer. I thought, well, that was all worth it for this one moment. And without doubt, looking back in my life so far, that those few seconds walking in there were amongst the most special, and including, you know, the birth of your children or, you know, anything else, getting married. It was right up there. It was a really, really special moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
That's amazing. And we talked a lot about the sort of mental side of your sport. Physically, how tough is it? Because you touched on it there, being 36, you were pretty old to be doing what you were doing. Mm. How much, you kind of like, how finely tuned are you and how much physical effort do you need to put into to each event?
Well, because it's a sprint event, although the races are quite short, it means the intensity is maximal. So every session you do, every training session, if you can't do 100% effort, there's no point in training. So it's physically, I'd say it's as hard mentally as it is physically. So every single day you come in, you can't just turn in and sort of do a session, get through it, either do it properly or don't do it at all. So you have this mentality of being able to switch on focus for a few seconds and then switch off. So you can be in the track center on a training day, having a laugh with your teammates. And then as soon as your name gets called to go on the track, it's like switch on, you step on the track, full intensity, being really like true 100% effort. And you can be lying on the ground afterwards, throwing up, you know, it's physically, it's a really grim event to train for. Certainly the 1000 meter time trial, the amount of lactic acid or amount of lactate your body produces, that real burning sensation. It's not pleasant, but it's what you have to do to get the best out of yourself. So every single session, you are on the limit. And the confidence you would get from knowing that there's nothing more you could do in your training sessions, in literally every single effort of every single session, if you gave 100%, when you got to the start line on race day every 4 years, you could almost take the pressure off. You knew that, well, if I win, I win. If I don't win, I don't win, because, you know, you got to shake the guy's hand if he beats you, fair enough. But as long as you've done everything you can within your powers to be the best you can be, That's all you can ask for.
As long as your hand sanitizing after you shake his hand.
Yeah, exactly. Fist bump him. Yeah.
I don't know if I've made this up, but I seem to remember somewhere you saying that your thighs were bigger than your wife's waist. Is that true? Have I made
well,
that?
It all started because, you know, good old Daily Mail or whoever the tabloids were, the first thing they wanted to know. So after, like, you know, you got all these journalists who follow your career when you're competing, and then all of a sudden the Olympics, all the tabloid journalists pile in and want to know everything. And so it was like, wow, look, how big are your legs? 27 inches. And then they sort of came back and said, that's bigger than Posh Spice's waist. And I was like, wow. And then, so then it was like, well, and then my waist, like, well, that's bigger than my waist too. And it just one of these things that people used to say, you know, they used to compare Posh Spice's waist to my legs. But in, I think, yeah, a lot of people have waists that are smaller than my legs. Maybe not now, but yeah.
That's great though. And then how did you feel after competing at the British Olympics in 2012? Because you spoke earlier about sort of not getting your kicks in the same way. That must have been some kind of come down after London 2012.
Well, it was, but it was also, I kind of realised in that time that it was the end of my career. I certainly knew that it was my last Olympic Games. I was hoping to try and continue on until Glasgow 2014 for the Commonwealth Games, but certainly I knew it was my last Olympics. I'd hung on with, you know, by the skin of my teeth, really. My body was, I was picking up injuries. I wasn't recovering as well as I used to when I was younger. So I was able to just to almost reflect. It was a period of reflecting on my whole career and just being so grateful that it all worked out, because it was a tough old time. And all these things, whenever we had any, you know, we didn't have kids at that point, so Callum and Chloe weren't born, so we had this list of places we wanted to go to and visit, things we wanted to do. And whenever I was struggling and training or having a tough time, you know, we'd sit down in the evenings and write down, you know, on my phone and sort of add in a little thing, oh, let's go and visit that hotel, that restaurant, or go to that place in the world we've not been to yet. So we basically plotted this amazing holiday it was the start of 2013. And yeah, we went to all over the place. We went to Thailand, Cambodia, out to Australia. We drove the whole of the East Coast right up to in Queensland, North Queensland, back down. And then we flew into, went to Melbourne for the F1. And I got my first ever driving motorsport race. I raced in a celebrity challenge.
I remember.
I'm sure you were there for it. Yeah, yeah.
There.
And I got the car got absolutely smashed up. Came second in the end, but it was like dodging cars. It was crazy. But that really kind of ignited my passion for motorsport. I mean, I was already planning to do a bit of racing before that, but that, you know, as your first ever race, to be doing it in front of a, you know, Grand Prix audience on race weekend, it was absolutely amazing. But this was the most incredible holiday I had. And I thought, you know what? I'm so lucky to have been through this amazing career and to have achieved what I never dreamt I would, even win one gold medal, let alone six. So although it's the end of your career, and you know, there is a period of mourning almost where your career is over and you realize that's it, and you're coming to terms with the fact that you're retiring, but it was just the chance I had all these new opportunities, the chance to start a family, you know, just an exciting time and having a bit of balance in your life as well, because you have to be so one-dimensional and focus on one thing for so long, it can be quite exhausting mentally to then have the balance and the chance to do new stuff and not worry about how your legs feel every morning when you wake up and kind of, you know, it used to roll out of bed and your body aches. And it was quite nice to have a bit more of a normal, you know, angle to your life.
Because I was going to ask you where the passion for motorsport came from, but really listening to you for the last half an hour or so, I can totally see it. Because you are interested in marginal gains, you are interested in preparation, controlling the controllables, all the things that we really focus and obsess about in Formula One. Mm. And presumably, you have been able to get some kind of adrenaline fix from your pursuit of motorsport. Just tell us about Le Mans, tell us about all the other events that you've been involved in and, you know, what you've made of it all.
Yeah, well, I was inspired by Colin McRae. He was my hero in motorsport, and I used to watch the World Rally all the time. And the fact that Colin did, you know, Dakar Rally, he did Le Mans himself. He got on the podium in Le Mans in GTE class. You know, he was an amazing guy, world champion, Scottish. So it was really thanks to Colin. A, he inspired me. And B, we did a documentary about his life and his career in 2013. And it was through the BBC and I was presenting it. So I got to meet Colin's family. And it was through that filming that I got a chance to race in a novice race series that year. And that's really where it all sort of started from, it spiraled from. But there, I guess motorsport, to people who maybe don't get it or who aren't interested in it, it's just, for me, the reason I love it so much, A, it's the obvious stuff, the speed, the adrenaline, the competition, that's amazing. But it's also being part of a team and having a common goal that you're all working towards and having, you know, I love the data, I love the detail you go into. And when I first started, I couldn't believe the difference that, you know, raising the ride height a centimetre or a few millimetres could make, you know, change, you know, the fact that the tyres can degrade so quickly and the effect that has on your lap times, all these tiny little things that go together to make this overall package, this performance package. So, yeah, I love it. And my level is, and I'm, you know, an amateur driver, I'm never going to be that great. But what I love about the sport is you can compete alongside professional drivers and you can look at your data, you can see how you can improve, you can see what they're doing, you can see what you're doing. And Le Mans is the pinnacle of that kind of program competition. And Le Mans, I had a Skeletric set when I was a kid. It was a Le Mans edition. I had two Porsche 911s with lights on them. And so I'd always been interested in Le Mans from, you know, 5 or 6 years of age. And then 2016, I managed to progress through the ranks. We won the European Le Mans Series in 2015 to qualify for Le Mans. And there I was pulling out the pit lane, going down the Mulsanne straight, and Mark Webber's going past in the Porsche. And I'm just thinking, this is absolutely incredible. You know, it was a real sort of pinch yourself moment to be out there on the track at such an iconic race, living your dream.
That's a miracle. You've got the thighs to get in there. I mean, you know, yeah. You know, you're not small. All these races are like little whippets, aren't they? You
know. Yeah, they are. And that's the thing. You know, big legs don't help you in motorsport. In fact, I've broken more brake pedals on the simulator. So there was Nissan were my sort of main sponsor and supporter up to Le Mans. And we had a sim that I used to use. And they kept coming back with tougher and tougher rubber bushings for the brake pedal. Because they said, you've got to hit it hard. I was like, okay, I'll hit it hard. And they're like, no, not well. Okay, we'll get a stronger pedal for you. And I just kept breaking them. So in the end, it was just this realization that, yeah, strong legs don't really make a difference in motorsport, sadly.
One format that I love, that I know you took part in, was Race Champions. Because it's the idea that you put everyone in on a level playing field, because everyone's always arguing like who the best racer is. And you partnered with Grosjean, didn't you? Tell us about
that. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so basically I got a call from David Coulthard about Wednesday that week. And I was due to be going down there anyway at Wembley. And there was a celebrity challenge where it was basically just in an aerial atom doing a little route around cones in the track centre. And David said, I think it was Lorenzo or somebody had injured themselves and they needed someone to step in. And it just so happened that was the season where we won the European Le Mans Series. So technically, I was a champion that year in motorsport, albeit the amateur side of a pro-am team. And he said, do you want to come down and do this, race of champions? I was like, well, of course I do. But equally, I don't want to make an idiot myself because I'm up against, the F1 drivers, the rally drivers, all the best drivers in the world. And he said, don't worry about it. Even if you're, way off the pace, you're only going to be a couple of seconds behind. And on a short circuit, it doesn't look that bad. Just have fun. Come down and get involved. And I did. I got down and I had about 45 minutes of practice on the empty track. And then it was straight in the deep end. I think I was against Pascal Wehrlein, or I'm not sure it was. There's a couple of different races, but it wasn't too bad. I was about maybe at one point, I was just under 2 seconds down after the race. So it wasn't like I was a million miles off, but what an experience. Yeah, a fantastic, fantastic time and a great celebration, a great party afterwards as well.
Yeah, I bet it was. Oh, Pascal Wehrlein, that is such a blast from the past. You know, there was a time where they were talking about him being the next big thing in Formula One and it's fallen away from him.
But he had that massive crash, I think it was 2 or 3 years later at the Race of Champions, where he flipped it and landed on top of it. Because I remember at the time, it's all on a very tight track and it's all sort of fun. But it just, motorsport is one of these things that, you never ever get complacent with it. You're always aware of the dangers. You analyze the risks and you take that on board and you go out there and you try and minimize the risks. But yeah, just even on a fun event like that, he had a really serious crash and he was fine, but yeah, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember now wondering how much that had compromised him, either physically or mentally, like coming psychologically into the Formula One season with this dodgy neck. But yeah, it'd be interesting. We should find out how he's getting on.
In the Pink and Bose want to support you in whatever way we can during these uncertain and constantly evolving times. So we're giving away more noise-cancelling headphones to bring some added calm to your life. To win the headphones, just tag in the 3 friends you're most looking forward to reconnecting with once lockdown is fully lifted. Always include the hashtag Bose and those headphones could be yours. Good luck. And stay connected.
Let's talk more about your family, because I remember being pregnant at the same time as your wife. Our baby boys were due at the same time, and then getting a message from you saying, actually, she's gone into labour very early and frighteningly early, and suddenly everything was turned on its head. We know that there's a happy ending to this, but just recount that that time for you, because that must have been incredibly scary.
Yeah, it was 2014 and Callum was due to be born in around Christmas time. And Sarah, she was starting to feel a little bit unwell, having these sort of, I guess, chest pains and heartburn and just not feeling very well. What's the number? 112, is it? No, what's the number for it? Yeah, that's it. And so I was sleeping. So she called it and just said, up for advice. And then she woke me up and said, oh, there's an ambulance coming. And I was like, what are you talking about? She said, there's an ambulance coming. They want to take me to hospital just for a checkup. And I was just like, oh, God, classic overreaction from Sarah. But, they obviously got the wrong end of the stick. There's nothing wrong with you. Just, take a Rennie. You'll be fine. Go back to bed, darling. You'll be okay. They took her in. And it was like, well, we think you might have had a mild heart attack. And we're not really sure what the issue is, because all your other physical indicators are that you're healthy and there's no risk of heart attack in your family and you're everything else is fine. So we can't work out why it is. So we're going to keep you in for a bit longer. Long story short, through HELLP syndrome and preeclampsia, she was going to have Callum early. So he was only 29 weeks at that point. And it was just this, and she was barely even showing a bump at that stage. And it was just this feeling of, well, you know, it's just a tiny little bean in there. It's not, you know, it's not a fully grown baby. This is not really looking that great. And it was just really scary. And you're trying to be as supportive and calm and relaxed about it on the outside so that, you know, you can be reassuring to your wife, to Sarah. But it was scary as hell, really scary. And then he was born about, I think, 48 hours later. And it was, yeah, he was 2 pounds 2 when he came out. So he was this tiny little thing. Literally, you know, you could hold him and sort of cup him in 2 hands. And he was straight into the neonatal ward and living in an incubator with tubes and wires and machines. And, you know, Sarah didn't even see him for the first couple of days. She couldn't come up to see him because she wasn't well enough. And it was just a really hard time. And you never, yeah, I guess you draw upon all the experience you have of dealing with pressure and dealing with, you know, in your sporting life and trying to apply it to something that's way more serious and way more terrifying. And just taking it one day at a time and thinking about the things that, again, the things you can do, things you can control, and not worry about the things that you can't control. But yeah, as you say, the happy ending to the story is that he's now 5 and a half and he's the tallest in his class and he's, you know, at normal school and he's riding around on his bike and he's doing great. And it is amazing. You know, once you have a premature baby, you're exposed to this whole new world that you never knew existed, really. Other families, other people who have been born prematurely themselves, or, you know, stories of all these different journeys these families have gone through. So Sarah's now an ambassador for Bliss, that's a neonatal charity. And it's just, you know, every day, you know, he must get sick of us saying it to him, because every day we're like, come here, son, let me look at your feet. Your feet are massive. How have you grown so much? Look how tall you are, you know, because we've got all these pictures of him as a little tiny, tiny little thing. And his, you know, his feet were like about that long. And now they're, you know, they're about that size. He's got like massive feet. So yeah, it is incredible how far he's come and how much it changes your perspective on life when you suddenly realize these are the important things, not winning medals on a bike riding around tracks. You know, this is what life is about.
Are there any signs of his premature birth? Because I know that they can sort of rear up later, you know, after.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ongoing. And it's, you know, in terms of, you never really know. And it's funny because you never know what's just the personality or the sort of characteristics of your child and whether that's just down to the genes or whether it's down to the fact they were born prematurely. It was tough. You know, the first 18 months were really tough because although we got him out of hospital after about, it was 2.5 months, I think he was in for, it was, you know, he was far more susceptible to respiratory infection and there was big risk of, you know, that kind of thing. So for 6 months, really, he was kept away from the outside world. We didn't take him out at all. And then, you know, he was in and out of hospital a fair few times. And it was, you never kind of get this feeling of, you know, all clear, everything's fine. He's, you know, he's normal and he's fine. And it's great because, yeah, as you say, there's all sorts of things can transpire in later life. But I guess what we have learned is you just take it one day at a time and you enjoy the good bits. I mean, one of the bad parts of it, and again, who knows if it's anything to do with his prematurity or not, but he just didn't sleep. He didn't sleep until he was about 2.5. It just about killed us. And, you know, he would sleep for, you know, it'd be 20 minutes or half an hour and then wake up for, it could be an hour or 2 hours and back down for 40 minutes and then up for another 2 or 3 hours. You could have maybe 2.5 hours sleep in a night broken into little 20 minute segments. And it was, you know, and I was trying to work through as well. And it was, for all of us, it was a tough time. But then Chloe came along and she slept like, when she's sleeping now, she's been in bed for about an hour now. She sleeps 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon and then 12 hours at night. And it's absolutely, she's in just 2.5 years old now. It's incredible, like the complete, the contrast between the two of them. But yeah.
You brought them up the same way. I find that fascinating about kids. There's the same DNA, they've been brought up the same way and they're so different. I tell you what, my daughter dropped her daytime sleep at about 2. She's now 3. Mm-hmm. She hasn't done it for well over a year. Mm-hmm. And God, it's that.
You miss it.
Yeah, because when they have a nap 2 hours a day, you get jobs done. You might even have a little sneaky sleep yourself.
Yeah, oh, it's brilliant. I mean, it's because it also gives you time. So Callum now gets a bit of one-on-one time with Sarah and myself, yeah. Which I think is important. You know, it's just to try and give them a bit of your attention. And yeah, it's wonderful when they get that peace in the house. And because often the noise usually is two of them either just playing, having fun, or arguing with each other and screaming and shouting. And it's, when she's in bed, it's usually quite calm and quite quiet.
Oh, look, I'm so happy that it's worked out so well, because I know I mean, I remember it happening and thinking that's got to be the scariest thing for any parent. So it's great. Mm. Doing 9 miles on a bike, that's more than I can do. That's amazing. Now, I know something else that matters to you is being an advocate for mental health. Why is that important?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was in 2008. Sam Acher, the Scottish Mental Health Charity, came to me and asked if I'd be interested in becoming an ambassador for them. And there were quite a few charities that were coming on board at that time, or, you know, approaching me after the games in Beijing. And I guess it was because one of my heroes is Graeme O'Bree. He's a Scottish, he was a Scottish world champion cyclist back in the mid-90s. And he was my hero. And I got to meet him, and I was actually a teammate in 1997, my second world championships in Australia. And we shared a room, we were teammates. And I got to know him, and he was like, you know, my idol. And I was, all these stories, I was asking about what happened here in this race and tell me about that. And I must have been really annoying just asking so many questions. But it was an incredible couple of weeks. And then it sort of transpired that he'd been suffering with mental health problems all his life. I think he's attempted suicide on a number of occasions. And, you know, it all came out that he was, you know, he'd had this struggle through his whole life. He wrote a book, his autobiography, which then became a film that Johnny Lee Miller played Graham in. It was an amazing, amazing film called The Flying Scotsman. And I guess it was because up until that point, I assumed that if here's somebody who's got everything, they've got the gold medal, they've got the success, this is what I want. And in my mind, if you have that, you'll be happy. That will be your success in life and you'll be content. And yet he was obviously struggling so much with this torment that he had within himself. So it can open my eyes to what mental health was, you know. And nowadays everyone's talking about mental health, and it's far more likely to talk about it, and people are far more aware of it and the importance of talking and monitoring your mental health on a daily basis. But this was the first time I'd ever seen or spoken to anybody who was really had mental illness, and was I guess I thought we've got to do something about this and talk about it more. So when Sam H came to me and said, "Would you like to come on board as ambassador?" I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to pay a tribute to my hero Graham. And Graham's still going strong now, and he's still suffering with mental health problems, but I think he's getting more robust and he's learning to deal with it in a better way. But yeah, I guess it's you look back 10 years and think how much it has changed. You know, every night on the news there'll be a talk about mental health. It's on the agenda now politically. It's on, you know, the forefront. Even the worst category are sort of middle-aged men. Well, certainly for suicide, you know, it's the biggest killer of men aged, I think, 25 to 50. But us blokes, we don't want to talk about our feelings or you know, our mental health. But now I think it's becoming far easier to do so.
And I guess it is people like you being the role models and being the ambassadors that's encouraging that and showing that it is something that we all need to talk about, even as a six-time Olympic gold medalist.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's like the rugby guys, the football guys, the kind of the manly men, you know, that are sort of perceived by the general public. They're the guys who have the biggest impact, I think, because if the bloke in the pub can see that, you know, some 6'8" second row forward can be talking about their mental health, then it's okay for them to be talking about it too. And also understanding that mental health is no different to your physical health. It's a sliding scale. You know, we all have days where we wake up in the morning, we feel good. There's days when we wake up, we don't feel quite so good, but that's fine. But if you talk about it and you're aware of it and you think about things that you can do to make yourself feel better, and the connection between physical exercise and physical health and your mental well-being is well documented too. So it's just getting the message out there and trying to help people and make and, you know, cut down on those figures of suicide rates. Mm-hmm.
So with all of that in mind, what do you now do? Having retired from sport, you've obviously busy with your family, but how do you keep your physical and mental health as strong as it can be?
I guess, well, the two are so closely linked, so I have to have a bit of exercise every day just for both those reasons, really, to stay fit and healthy mentally and physically, and just to have a bit of structure, because my days, my weeks are so, well, until the last few weeks with the lockdown, but prior to lockdown, your days and your weeks are so different. I don't have a normal week. I don't have a normal, you know, working week like I used to in the old days. So my exercise becomes the one constant I have throughout every day in a week. So I just try and find some time, whether it's on the indoor bike at home here, if I'm traveling, I'm ambassador for Pure Gyms. So there's Pure Gyms all over the country, so I can get access to a Pure Gym anywhere, virtually, wherever I am. So I just try and do a little bit every day and have a little target before each session. So I have a little challenge for myself. I'm still squatting and lifting quite heavy because I quite enjoy that. And I can monitor that compared to what I used to do when I was still competing. But yeah, just getting out the bike with the kids now as well. Riding the bike is so much fun. And I've got to stay fit to keep up with Callum. He's doing 9 miles in a ride, so.
Little legend. Oh, that's great. It's been so good to talk to you, Chris. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Likewise.
Food for thought and inspired, I'm sure, a few people to get out there and back on their bikes, even if it's just static in the garden or in their house.
Exactly.
That's great.
Thanks, Natalie.
Good luck with everything. Love to all the family. And
thank
I hope
you.
To see you in the flesh soon.
Take care. All the best.
Thank you.
See you later. Bye. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you, Sir Chris, for your time. Thank you for your insight into what was a hugely successful career, incredible winning mentality, and a seemingly seamless transition to life after professional sport. Also, always good to have a fellow motorsport lover on the podcast. Loads more great podcast guests on the way, including Jason Plato, who, as you know, I'm sure, is a great storyteller. He's written a book. He tells me all about that and some of the stories that didn't make the cut because they were, quite frankly, too naughty. So it's well worth a listen. He's another hugely successful racer who is also a very good egg. So Jason Plato on the way on In The Pink very soon. And don't forget, we could be giving you a pair of Bose noise-cancelling headphones. All you need to do is tag in the three friends on Instagram, either on my account or the In The Pink podcast account, who you are most looking forward to reconnecting with once lockdown is fully lifted. Add the hashtag Bose and those headphones could be yours. Until next time, my friends, stay healthy, stay safe, look after yourselves and each other, and we'll see you very soon on In The Pink.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.